William I. Drew versus William L. Drew versus the state of Illinois.
Morning. May it please the court, my name is James Baker. I'm appearing this morning on behalf of William Drew. Mr. Drew is a long-term employee of the state of Illinois who maintained charges before the District Court of Race Discrimination in connection with his employment in the Bureau of Collections for the Illinois Department of Human Services. Mr. Drew joined the Bureau as a statistical research associate in 1996, and the gravamen of his claims for purposes of this appeal relate to events which occurred between late 1998 and August of 1999 when he filed his charge of employment discrimination. He alleges before the district court multiple acts of discriminatory treatment, and the time allotted to me today, I would like to speak to only two of them. The first is his claim that he was denied overtime compensation. And the gist of his claim is that he was denied that type of benefit, notwithstanding the fact that he had work which justified it, while individuals doing work at a similar work responsibility level who were Caucasian were allowed to do that work. Now, during the summary judgment proceeding and during discovery before that, I submit to the court that there are a number of material fact propositions which are either not disputed, or if they are disputed, are the type of issues which should find its way to a finder of fact. The first proposition is that in late 1998, or beginning in late 1998 and continuing into 1999, there was a dramatic increase in the level of duties assigned to Mr. Drew. Those duties generally, not always, but generally involved work assignments which were outside of his job position, and many of those duties were done normally by individuals holding a higher position classification. He received and had no training or prior experience to equip him to perform those duties. All of that occurred while his regular duties remained unchanged. Point number two, Mr. Drew was a statistical research associate. He was the only one in his unit. And I think the record will reflect it was a relatively small unit, at least in terms of the size of units in state government go. There were in that work unit other individuals called quality review analysts, I believe, who, although they had different duties and functional responsibilities, were similar to Mr. Drew in several respects. First, they were professional positions, at least in the sense that they were not clerical positions, and they were not supervisory positions. They performed types of functions that required a certain level of expertise and training.
How do they become professional?
I think professional is a term of art that's used within state government. It means essentially that it takes a certain level of training to do what they do. They don't supervise other individuals, and they do work beyond a secretarial or clerical level of work.
Does that have to do with being exempt from overtime, right?
No, it's not.
That's what I was going to ask you next.
No, there's nothing in this record that would suggest that to be the case. And both of these positions were covered by the same bargaining unit. The other undisputed proposition, is that at some time between late 1998 and March of 1999, Mr. Drew, on at least two separate requests, asked that he be allowed to work overtime. Each of those requests was denied. Now, prior to making those requests, or at least at a time proximate to making them, he had informed his supervisor, who was relatively new in supervising him, with what his duties were. He prepared a detailed list of his duties, and his supervisor felt that by early 1999 he had a good handle on the duties the plaintiff was performing. Next, undisputed proposition.
Wait, on the other hand, did the people who had that job before have overtime pay?
There was never anyone before that had this job.
Well, that did the same type of work.
There was never anyone before that did exactly the same type of work.
Wasn't his request for overtime because of what he classified as accounting work?
He was temporarily given the work that formerly had been given to an accountant. That was one of a number of duties he was assigned. That was a temporary assignment he was given. And I think the best way to describe it is he was given a hodgepodge of responsibilities that had been held by a variety of other people prior to him. Some were responsibilities that supervisors had. One was a temporary assignment that an accountant had. So it was not as if that there was any one person who prior to this time did exactly the same thing he did. And the record is that he was the only person in the unit that had his particular position description.
Well, he was the one person that happened to do that combination of tasks. Not that each of those tasks were new. They were just put under him. So
correct. They were new to him.
So a supervisor would at least know what those tasks are about and how much time they should take.
The supervisor knew what the tasks were. His testimony in his deposition was he did not know precisely how much time they would take.
And then somebody did a time study. Right?
Yes, which brings me to my next point. This was a relatively small unit, and it was headed by a woman named Marcia Weary. And Marcia Weary, although she was not Mr. Drew's direct supervisor, had a significant amount of responsibility and oversight with this overtime issue. She was one of the individuals that assigned him new work, and she was also the individual that had some role in considering his overtime request by doing it. The district court, in its opinion, granted summary judgment on this issue based upon its conclusions that Mr. Drew could not establish that the employer's explanation for denying him overtime was pretextual. The state in its brief speaks to the concept that Mr. Drew could not establish a prima facie case of discrimination, so you didn't even need to get to the pretext issue. And in doing it, they make several points that I would like to speak to. Point number one is they assert that there was no material adverse employment action because overtime was indefinite, it was discretionary, and I would submit to the court that the record in this case is that individuals within his bargaining unit who did quote-unquote professional type work, when they reached the point where they needed more time other than the normal work time to perform the duties, they were granted it. Now, Mr. Drew...
Counsel, do you realize you're into your rebuttal?
I do, Your Honor, but I think this is something that I should cover. QCR's... Mr. Drew was the only statistical research assistant, but he was the only... he had no one else to compare himself to in that unit, and the closest point of comparison were QCR's. Who, in the Radu case, which is cited in the state's brief, it talks about the concept of how one considers comparable employees, and it suggests that you consider comparability within the context of the claim. And in this case, the claim is he was denied overtime that he needed it. Other professional employees were granted that overtime. Second point they make is that there's no showing that There was a common supervisor involved in the decision. Well, the reality is Marcia Wurry, who oversaw the Bureau and was supervising all employees in the unit, was involved in this particular decision to deny him overtime.
Is she the one that concluded he should be able to do it in 80 hours?
Yes.
And when he had 134?
Correct. Which gives rise to another point. Excuse me. I think I'm out of time.
Your time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Counsel.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Mary Welsh. I'm here on behalf of the Department of Human Services. Your Honor, this is a simple case of failure of proof. The Court is surely aware of the McDonnell-Douglas prima facie case or test for Title VII cases. And here, the plaintiff simply failed to meet his burden on two of these for every one of his claims. The first one is that he failed to come up with similarly situated employees in all relevant aspects. And the second one is that he failed to show that there was a materially adverse employment action in any of the five areas that he was complaining about in his complaint. I too will address primarily the overtime request because that's the one that the plaintiff has started with. Courts don't decide job duties. Employers decide what is an appropriate job duty, what is an appropriate scope of work for their employees. And unless there is some kind of deceit, I mean, this court has said, we quote in our brief, unless there's some sort of deceit or fraud or something, and there's evidence of that, courts don't meddle in the day-to-day job assignments of employees under Title VII. And in particular, something like overtime. Overtime is very discretionary. It's decided under the union contract on a number of factors. These include the priority of the task, how overworked the people are, if there's a deadline. And all the plaintiff says is, well, these other people who he testified at his deposition have very different job duties. What they do, what the quality control reviewers do, is put together agreements to pay back money to the state, whereas what his job is as a statistical research specialist is to do exactly what he was asked to do, which is to put together data for reports. So even from the superficial sense, quality control reviewers are not similarly situated because they don't have the same kinds of job responsibilities that a specialist, a statistical specialist does. Now, in addition, under Title VII, you're supposed to show, particularly for discretionary decisions, that you have the same supervisor. Mr. Drew was a unit of one. He reported directly to Mr. Hagee. He was the only person in his unit, and in fact, this is one of the things he complained about when he complained that he was not included in other units' social activities. So he fails in his similarly situated prima facie case because he can't show that the QCRs are similarly situated. They don't have the same job responsibilities and they don't have the same supervisor. And he failed to show that although the QCRs get overtime because they have deadlines. You know, when there's a tax refund coming and the state has a certain period to offset that, that might prompt the department to authorize overtime because of the deadline. He didn't show, there's no evidence here to show that he had this kind of deadline when he made his request. Furthermore, there was no evidence to show that the QCRs, and there was evidence to show about plaintiffs, that he tended to wander around, that he was often seen not doing his job, talking to other people, and doing tasks even when he was at his own desk, which were not the tasks that he was assigned to. And there was no evidence to dispute that both Wary and Ms. Wary and Mr. Hagee, his immediate supervisor and Ms. Wary, the supervisor for Mr. Hagee, and she was in fact the bureau chief for collections, that their observations were not true. He never disputed this in the district court. Furthermore, when you get to the notion of pretext, even it, and this is the ground on which the district court found that Mr. Drew's title prima facie case failed with regard to his overtime request. What we saw here was that Ms. Wary went to the people who in fact had done the work. She asked them, how much time did it take you to do the work that we have now assigned to Mr. Drew? They told her. She put this together. She explained at her deposition. She reviewed what his assignments were. She reviewed his output. She reviewed his job classification. And she determined, as it was within her discretion to do, that he did not, that the circumstances there did not require them to authorize overtime. And again, part of this was, this decision was grounded in her and Mr. Drew's immediate supervisor, Mr. Hagee's observations, that Mr. Drew was in fact not spending all his time doing the tasks that he was assigned. And so, and because those observations were not disputed, again, Mr. Drew simply failed to come up with enough evidence to create a question of fact as to either his prima facie case or pretext. There's simply no evidence in the record to show that either Ms. Wary or Mr. Hagee did not believe that Mr. Drew, in fact, if he were spending his time at his desk doing his work, would not have required overtime. And just briefly with regard to the other points, in the vacation request, the first request was in 97. It was untimely because it wasn't within the 300 days of Mr. Drew's 1999 EEOC charge. The second request was sometime in 98. We don't know when it was. So even if it was within the 300 days, again, this, like a bonus, is very discretionary, and the only evidence he has that another person, a Caucasian, had a vacation request granted is hearsay, and it's not admissible. And the court didn't overlook that evidence. It explicitly said, the district court said, I'm not considering that evidence. That's hearsay, and thus it's not competent on summary judgment. Also, we don't know the nature of the two requests. Did the QCR's request, we assume she's a QCR, was her request for one day at a time when things were slow? Was his request for 2 weeks at a time when people were under the gun? We don't know. And if we don't know that they're similarly situated, then, again, Mr. Drew has failed to come up with enough evidence to create his prima facie case. There was no response, there was no finality to the decision. And because of this, we don't know if he had gone back to say, hey, you know, did my vacation request get lost? I made this. They might have said yes. Again, we don't know. And again, this is another reason that Mr. Drew failed in his prima facie case on the vacation request. With regard to the reclassification, the same thing is true. There is nothing to show that Mr. Drew was qualified for a promotion or reclassification. And in fact, in his affidavit at paragraph 32, he says that CMS told him, the Department of Central Management Services, which is the department that decides what the qualifications are, that he didn't have qualifications for accounting position. So he again failed his prima facie case with regard to that claim because he couldn't show that he was qualified for a promotion into the sort of position that he was seeking. He also didn't show that there was an opening. When you're deciding a promotion Title VII claim, you have to show both that you're qualified and that someone else got the promotion that was no more qualified than you. Well, he didn't show that anyone else had gotten a promotion that was not more qualified than he was. In fact, he didn't show that there was a promotion to be had. So again, he fails in his prima facie case with regard to the promotion. Lastly, there were two other claims that Mr. Drew made. One was the undesirable cubicle. The other one was the he wasn't invited out to lunch by his supervisor, Mr. Hagee. There's no evidence in the record to show that Mr. Hagee invited anybody else out. And surely this court is not going to, Title VII does not require supervisors to take their people out to lunch. I mean, again, courts are not micromanagers, particularly of the social interactions of employees. And Title VII wasn't intended to be a courtesy standard. All it is to show that there is no discrimination, no materially adverse effect on the terms and conditions of employment. And Mr. Drew, again, simply failed to show, make his prima facie case that there was a materially adverse effect on his employment here and that he was treated less favorably than anyone who was not in his protected class. We ask the court to affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We will